From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Dutch crime novelist Jan Willem van de Wettering. He grew up in Holland during the German occupation, became a Buddhist monk, then was a cop, and is now author of the popular Amsterdam murder mysteries. His 13th installment, The Hollow-Eyed Angel, is set in New York City. Also, putting a new spin on the Baby Elephant Walk, the Pink Panther theme, and Moon River, we talk with Matt Brubeck about reinterpreting the music of Henry Mancini. Brubeck is a cellist and bassist and leader of Orange Symphonette. Their debut album is devoted to Mancini's music. And yes, Matt is the son of jazz pianist Dave Brubeck. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Several shots were fired a short time ago inside the Japanese ambassador's home in Lima. Hostages have been held there by Peruvian leftist rebels for nearly 1 month. There's been no explanation for the shots and no indication if anyone's been hurt. Earlier, the rebels rejected a Peruvian government proposal to end the standoff. John Miller reports from Lima.
In the plan, the government promised to set up an independent commission, including representatives of the Red Cross and the Catholic Church, to hear the rebels' grievances. But the rebel commander sent a message saying any government proposal must include the release of rebel prisoners from Peruvian jails. Hope had been raised over the weekend that the dialogue was entering a new phase, with a face-to-face meeting planned yesterday between the two sides. But that meeting was canceled after the rebels rejected the government offer. President Alberto Fujimori is involved in another piece of delicate diplomacy today. He's hosting the president of Ecuador, who's here on a state visit. The two countries have clashed several times over a disputed border, most recently in 1995. The Ecuadorian president has publicly supported Fujimori in his handling of the hostage crisis. For National Public Radio, I'm John Miller in Lima.
Arguments in the Supreme Court case of Clinton versus Jones are over. The attorneys for Paula Jones spoke to the reporters on the steps of the Supreme Court a short time ago. Jones accuses President Clinton of sexual harassment in 1991, while she was governor, or rather he was governor of Arkansas, and she was a state employee. The justices will decide whether the sexual harassment case may go forward and not on the merit of her allegations. It's another bitterly cold day in the Midwest. Most temperatures won't climb out of the single digits in Middle America. Mark Moran of member station WOI in Des Moines has this report.
A massive blast of Arctic air is responsible for the bitter cold, which stretches from the Idaho Panhandle east to Kentucky and from the Canadian Yukon south to the Texas Gulf Coast. The bone-chilling cold comes as no surprise to climatologists, who have forecast this to be the coldest winter on record in the region since 1917. Elwin Taylor is a state climatologist in Iowa.
And so the very coldest temperatures in Montana primarily, and then spreading out from there.
The temperature reached 41 degrees below zero in Havre, Montana over the weekend. The coldest wind chill reading was recorded in Minot, North Dakota, 82 below. The good news, the winds have finally subsided, winds that made the air cold enough to freeze exposed skin in minutes. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
A poll by Newsweek magazine finds most Americans would like a say in how their Social Security contributions are invested. 71% of respondents want control over the money, and half would like to see some of it put into the stock market. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 10.5 points at 6,714. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, stock prices rose earlier today on the strength of better-than-expected corporate profits. The Dow is up 10.5 points, while the Standard & Poor 500 index is up 1.5 points. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Stock prices rose after J.P. Morgan said its fourth-quarter profits were higher than expected. As a result, its price rose above $100 a share. Analysts said there's a growing consensus among investors that overall corporate profits will be higher for the year. That, coupled with a relatively stable bond market, sent stock prices somewhat higher throughout the morning. The relatively strong performance suggests that the market's rally last week hasn't yet run its course. The Dow Jones Industrial Average had four record closes last week and even managed to shake off concerns about inflation following Friday's unexpectedly strong unemployment report. This is Jim Zaroli in New York.
Tokyo stocks rebounded today, closing up nearly 5% in the biggest one-day gain in a year and a half. The Nikkei fell 11% last week. Investors are worried that Japan's economy will weaken significantly after new taxes take effect in April. Today, analysts say investors rushed to find bargains. American Airlines is warning of an impending pilot strike. The National Mediation Board has declared an impasse in talks between the carrier and the pilots' union. American's president, Robert Crandall, has released a letter saying a mid-February walkout is very possible unless a deal is struck during the 30-day cooling-off period imposed by the mediation board. The board has offered binding arbitration. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation for reporting on disadvantaged youth and families, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is a detective novelist who has not only worked as a cop, he spent 2 years studying in a Zen monastery in Japan. So it's no surprise that the bantering between the regular characters in his series, two cops and the chief of detectives, often has a philosophical edge. The author, Jan Willem van de Wettering, who now lives in Maine, grew up in Amsterdam and was a child during the German occupation of Holland. It was in Amsterdam that he worked as a cop. Most of his novels are set there, but in the latest, The Hollow-Eyed Angel, the Amsterdam chief of police, who's about to retire, comes to New York in response to a request to help solve a murder in Central Park. I asked van de Wettering to describe his position when he was a cop.
I was with the Reserve Constabulary of Amsterdam, but that's not really like an auxiliary force in the way you have it in other countries. We wore the same uniform as the Amsterdam Municipal Police, and we had the same training. The only thing was that we worked in our free time, our weekends, and holidays, and we did the whole training also in our free time. So we had regular jobs at the same time. And the reason that I got into that was I left Holland when I was 19. I came back when I was 34. And I got arrested by the military police for not telling the Dutch consuls in foreign countries where I was in case Russia attacked and I have to help defend the country. So they wanted me to join the army at age 34 while I was already married and had a child and I had a good job in Holland at the time. So I'd rather not do that. But the choice was jail. So some lady at the office of the military police suggested that I'd quickly volunteer for the Amsterdam Voluntary Municipal Police because they definitely urgently needed extra people there. And once I was in the Queen's uniform as a policeman, I couldn't be in the army. So I did that, and it was just funny to me because I'm really an anarchist, and here I was in this splendid uniform with a hat and serving the Queen by upholding the law.
Are the characters in your mystery novels based on cops who you worked with in Amsterdam?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, the Sergeant here, I saw quite a few of his type, athletes and handsome men who were all out to have adventures in the city. You know, they really liked driving fast or demonstrating their skills in judo and without hurting the suspect. But I really like that type, and I think it's part of my character too. The sporting part of the police, and then the Grijpstra is the heavy, in Freudian terms, the super ego, the upholding the traditions of Holland, of the dignified behavior of idealized Dutchmen by his behavior. And I saw many of his type, too. And I was, for my early exams in the police, I was trained by people like that.
And what about the chief?
Yeah, he was a combination of a Zen master I met in Japan when I studied there in the Zen monastery in my 20s. And my father, who was a nice kind of guy. And an actual chief of detectives that I met in the force. I think those three went together in that figure. of the commissariats.
You studied Zen Buddhism or practiced Zen Buddhism for a couple of years at a monastery in Kyoto. Do you think that your experiences in a Zen monastery influenced your behavior as a cop?
Yes, it was all part of my general upbringing.
Are there specific ways you think it affected you?
Yeah, dealing with human crises. As a cop, you always deal with... I remember coming home late at night and finding my wife embroidering something in front of the TV, and I'd think, where's the corpse? Where's the blood? Who is needing assistance here? And in Zen, you also in training, you also deal with a continuous crisis, because your teacher, if you don't have the great doubt yourself, the great doubt about existence and about whether there is a meaning and a purpose and a pattern to life and whether you perform a useful part in there, if you have that doubt that maybe there's nothing at all, maybe it's just a great chaos, a great void and emptiness, if you don't have that doubt, the teacher will actually put it in you, and he will confront you with it every day. You have to see him early in the morning, and he says, well, what of it? And what of it, he means, is you're on Earth, and have you figured out what you're doing here? And tell me. And he gives you these strange riddle-like koans to meditate on that don't seem to make any sense, like, same thing with being a cop. When you look at the shadowy side of the suffering side of the humanity, you begin to doubt whether there's any sense to it.
But when you're a cop, you're kind of confronting that shadowy side day after day. When you're in a monastery, you're living in a secluded area, and you're through meditative practices confronting
this. Yeah, but
this
not in a Zen monastery.
No?
Yeah, you wake up at 3 because some idiot is banging on your door. and yelling at you and clapping clappers, and then you have to report in the hall within 5 minutes, and there you get beaten if you fall asleep, and then an hour later you have to see this fierce teacher who is like a dragon. You know, he just won't leave you alone. He'll drive you crazy, and then you have to do a lot of labor and hard work, and it's not your pleasant little hermit building where you sip tea and sit quietly.
What brought you to the Zen monastery in Kyoto? Why did you go?
Well, really, the war. I grew up in Rotterdam in Holland from a sort of comfortable family, and everybody knew exactly what they were doing, and we were living well. And then suddenly there was the war. All my schoolmates were Jewish and were killed. I'm not Jewish, so they left me alone, so I had survival guilt. And I began to seriously doubt what I was doing, whether I should continue my life, whether this wasn't a planet that you should get away from. And I mean by suicide, you know, child suicide does happen from time to time. I thought the whole thing was ridiculous. We did a lot of business with Germans, my father did, and there they were bombing us and trying to kill us. Rotterdam was bombed in May 1940. It was the start of the war for the Dutch. And I was right in the middle of that. So I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't accept life. But then life was pretty exciting too, because wars are exciting. You know, there's all that war material, the uniforms later. There were the British planes came every day, and there were big fights above the lakeside where I lived. And I saw people coming, dropping out of the sky when their planes were downed. I saw starvation. It was a very colorful and very strange experience. So I thought maybe I'd just hold off on the suicide and see if I could make sense of it later. And eventually, after college, I went to England and studied philosophy in London. That was after a stint in South Africa, where I worked for one of my father's companies for 6 years and saw apartheid starting up, which was another horror. So I went to England, studied philosophy, and I really didn't get the answers or any answers except by reading Nietzsche, who also doubts the purpose of life. And I really irritated my teachers there, I think.
Are you saying that you went to the Zen monastery because you were suicidal and nothing in your life, not philosophy classes, nothing else was was helping?
No, because my suspicion was that there was no purpose and there was only chaos. And
no purpose to life.
Yeah, and that cheered me up. Because if it isn't
there, you have. Okay.
Yeah, if it isn't there, then you don't have to worry about it.
Right, you don't have to have a purpose or a meaning if there isn't one to be had.
Yeah, and you could still, just to be perverse, do the very best you can.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what Nietzsche, I thought, was propagating. And I really got excited about that. And also about Heidegger and some of the existentialists who were coming from Sartre, for instance. And my teachers were just irritated by that and said, why don't you become a Buddhist instead of prattling about stuff like that? Enter the void, enter chaos, enter meaninglessness, as it is actually preached there in or Taoism or Hinduism. So I thought, yeah, why not? And so I went to, I started reading Buddhism. And Japan seemed like a good place because someone said if you get sick in Japan, you can go to a hospital and you get bored, you can go to the cinema. And you can't do that in Tibet or Calcutta so much. You know, Japan is an orderly country. And also, we had been at war with them. And a lot of my relatives were in Japanese camps in the Far East. So that would be another way to get to know a people who were we had murderous relations with just shortly before. So I did go to Kyoto and stayed 2 years.
Now, did you have to explain all this to your Zen monk? I mean, to your Zen teacher?
No. He was a he was a great guy. That's why I stayed 2 years. Because when I came in, he said through an interpreter, "So what do you want?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to know if there is a purpose to life." And he said, "Well, do you think there is?" And I said, "Well, I rather think there isn't." He said, "Oh, that's great. Then, because at the end of your training, you will find that it was all a big joke anyway." And I said, "Well, concentration camps are a joke." And he said, "Yeah, maybe. You know, why don't you follow the method and come to some understanding?" And then I said, and also I'd been in money-making businesses and I was bored with money. And he was a great actor. He got up and he said, "Don't tell me you don't have any money." And I said, no, it's okay. I brought some money." And he said, "What a relief." Because this monastery is a very expensive place to run. You know, things keep breaking down. They have to be fixed. And I smoke a lot of cigarettes. Cigarettes are getting very expensive. And if you have no money, I can't possibly have you here. I'll have to throw you out. So I said, no, don't worry, I have money. And then he charged me something like $6 a month.
It's so nothing, I mean,
yeah.
Right.
And I realized that these guys were wise guys, you know, they were having fun with me, and I liked that. I thought that was very amusing.
So when you left the monastery after 2 years, did you feel any differently about the meaning of life?
No, I thought I had completely wasted my time. I was really depressed when I left. I never understood my koan and
the Zen koan, the riddle that the teacher would give you. Mm-hmm.
And I was terrible at meditation, and my legs always hurt, and I couldn't stand the food. And the only guy I really liked was the teacher, and he was dying. He was suffering from Parkinson's disease, and he would have to retire pretty soon. And I thought I'd completely wasted my time, and I left and went to South America and got a job with a Dutch firm there. And for a while, I looked back thinking, what the hell was I trying to do there? But then it became clear that it had been a very meaningful exercise in meaninglessness. And I still think it's the greatest thing that ever happened to me now.
My guest is Dutch-born detective writer Jan Willem van de Wettering. His latest novel is called The Hollow-Eyed Angel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dutch-born detective writer Jan Willem van de Wettering. Well, you in a book that you wrote about your experiences with Zen Buddhism, you said that your master, your Zen master, said to you when you were leaving, "By leaving here, nothing is broken. Your training continues. The world is a school where the sleeping are woken up. You are now a little awake, so awake that you can never fall asleep again." Did those words have any meaning to you?
Yeah, I thought it was very nice of him to say that. And it would be nice if it was true. But I was more impressed by a character that he wrote for me, a Chinese character on a piece of paper, which the character for Mu, which means nothingness, the void, which was also the subject of my koan. And he put his own name on one side and my name on the other side. I thought that was a bit of a compliment that he would put me on the same. And he had done that before. I came at 3 o'clock in the morning. I came into his room and all miserable and itchy and bad-tempered. And there he was, climbing down from his cushions in his brocade robes and prostrating himself on the floor for me. And I said, "Hey, you know, are you okay?" And he said, no, "I'm paying my respects to Yon Velen Buddha." And I said, "How do you mean?" He said, "Well, you know as much as I do, and you've always known it. And all this doubt and agony and pain that you present every day is really just a sham, you know." And that sort of thing always cheered me up. That's why I'm 65 now and I'm still around.
I'm wondering if you ever wondered whether the depressions you were experiencing were because of what you saw during the war, or whether it was just something more internal about your particular mood. You know how there's all these theories now about how depression is really linked to biochemical factors, and, you know, sometimes you really wonder whether your worldview is based on what you've experienced or just based on your internal chemistry.
Yeah, but it wasn't the sort of depression that you can cure with Prozac. It's
right. You saw it. I mean, right.
I think it'll happen to any thoughtful person. Mm-hmm. Carl Jung, when he was a child, he had nice parents and he lived in, Carl Jung, the psychologist.
Yeah.
He was playing in the garden and he looked under some plants and he saw how ants are murdering a caterpillar. And then he went into that a little further and he saw how horrifying nature is. You know, everybody feeds on everybody else and all tearing each other up and cats playing with mice. And it will occur to anybody after a while. And I think any thoughtful person will then start pondering these matters. And they may be depressing, but they're also extremely interesting. Now, it's not the kind of depression where you think, well, I'll just shoot myself to have it over with. I was going to shoot myself to find God and beat him up. It was a fine thing to do. It was an adventure. You know, I wasn't going to just lie down and give up. Not that kind of depression at all.
What an interesting idea to kill yourself so you could find God and beat him up.
Yeah. My father was. He actually laughed, and he was a man weighed down by Christian grief and guilt, but when I told him that, he laughed. It was a good idea, he said. Try it.
What was the God you expected to find?
Well, what you were told in kindergarten, you know, an old guy with long hair and blue eyes and sort of beneficial. And I thought he was out of his mind if he was going to allow a whole class of little schoolboys, even if they were from expensive families and were taken to school in Mercedeses and Rolls Royces, to take them to Treblinka, where they were just being killed within 6 hours. And he had thought of that as guidance, as a lesson, as training for our souls. He must be crazy. You know, somebody should go and tell him that things weren't working out. Later, I had more subtle thoughts about it.
Let me get back to what happened to you when you were young. How old were you when World War II started?
9.
And no. You were going to a very expensive private school because your father was a financier.
Yeah,
he had
everything
a lot of money.
Just dandy. I walked through a park to school every day. But I did get mixed up in a hunger uproar one day. I strayed to the wrong side of town, and this was the 30s. So I was maybe 3-4 years old, and it was the Great Depression, and people were starving, and they were being subdued by Dutch military police with bearskins on horses, and they rode their horses right into these poor people and then threatened them with sticks and sabers. So I knew something was amiss even before the war started.
Right. And during the war, during the German occupation of Holland, you said what, that all of the Jewish students in your class were taken to Treblinka, and you were the only student who wasn't Jewish.
Yeah, and two little boys who I always rather liked, they were Germans, but they happened to be in Holland, and they appeared at school in Hitlerjugend uniforms. And they were my schoolmates, you know.
Did
because
you
what did they know? They were 10, 11 years old at the time.
So all the Jewish students taken together at the same
no,
time?
No, no, it went by address if you lived in a certain part of town. But most of them would have lived in the same area.
So every day there were fewer students?
There were fewer students, yeah. And they were wearing these yellow stars, and it was all ridiculous. But then later, we lived in a big house, a villa on the lakeside, and it was commandeered by the German army, but only half of it. So we had these, we were living in it, and German officers were living in it. And the officers all happened to come from Dresden in Germany, and that was one day completely destroyed, I think by the American Air Force, or by the British.
The firebombing.
The firebombing. So I saw the distress of these kids, you know, they were young officers in their 20s. And the next thing, they were sent to Russia, and that was a one-way ticket too, because nobody came back from Russia in those days. So the suffering was universal. It wasn't just, you couldn't say, well, if the Germans are bad guys and we are good guys, it was a very mixed picture.
See, I'm interesting that as a child facing all this, what you found was meaninglessness as opposed to just a terrible fear of life and fear of...
No, I'm not into fear. I never had it very much. I'm more adventurous. I travel a lot too. I lived in 10 different countries and I've done all sorts of things.
Jan Willem van de Wettering, his latest novel is called The Hollow-Eyed Angel, published by the Soho Press. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Uneasy Listening. We talk with Matt Brubeck, leader of the Orange Symphonette. Their debut album is devoted to reinterpreting the music of Henry Mancini. We'll also talk with Brubeck about his earliest musical influence, his father, Dave Brubeck. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jan Willem van de Wettering, the Dutch-born detective novelist. The latest novel in his series is called The Hollow-Eyed Angel. The philosophical edge of his novels is inspired in part by the 2 years he lived in a Zen Buddhist monastery in Japan. But he draws on many other aspects of his unusual life. You've really had an extraordinary life. After World War II and after you grew up, you've lived in, I don't know, about 10 different cities around the world, worked as everything from a real estate agent in Australia to you joined a motorcycle gang in South Africa. You were a cop in Holland. I don't even remember the other things you've done. But you've certainly been around. But you didn't start writing until you were 40.
Yeah, 41.
41. So what happened that you started to think about writing books?
Well, as a child, I couldn't, of course, couldn't read because I was too little, and everybody in the family read, and it drove me crazy that I couldn't read. So I would make lick my finger and rub the words out in my frustration, making them disappear and mutilating books that way. But I did learn to read, and I could read before I went to school, but then I could only read Dutch, and most of the books in the house were in English, so it still wasn't anyway. And I started borrowing books from the library. And apart from Winnie the Pooh and Wind in the Willows and in Dutch translations and Through the Looking Glass, Alice in Wonderland, I couldn't really find anything that interested me. And I started complaining at the library, saying that they had really trashy books there. And they said, well, if you don't like them, why don't you go home and write a book yourself? So I said, sure. And I went home. And I really wanted to write a book, but I couldn't. So I said, well, from then onward, whenever people asked me what I wanted to be, I said, I am already a writer, but I haven't written anything yet. And I kept that up till I was 41, and my mother-in-law begged me not to do that. Because it's ridiculous. You've never written anything, and you always tell people you're a writer. And I said, but I really am. You know, I just haven't written anything yet. And then that Japanese Zen monastery experience was so strong that became my first book. But it really, like the Zen master said, you know, don't force these things. It's like grabbing unripe apples off a tree. You jump up and you fall and you hurt your spine and the apples aren't good to eat. Just wait till they drop by themselves, and then you get so many that you don't even know what to do with them.
In your latest mystery novel, The Hollow-Eyed Angel, the police chief is getting ready to retire. And he's having this little talk with his pet turtle one day. and he's kind of thinking out loud about how he should face the danger that he knows he's about to face. In this case, he's investigating. And he's wondering if he should just try to face danger with detachment, kind of in that Zen spirit of facing things with detachment. But he says to himself, even now when my working life is almost over, who am I fooling? My career does matter to me. I'm in this to win. I insist on being admired. And I wonder if you've ever felt that sense of conflict about certain Zen principles pertaining to detachment.
Yeah, I know. I irritate my wife that way, too. Because on the one hand, I claim that nothing matters, and on the other hand, I try to do a very good job, and I'm very pleased when a book is published, and I get upset when I get a bad review. But that, I think, is just a personality. We all wear these masks that we have to wear to get through our lives, but they don't mean very much. And if you are aware of your own pride and greed and pettiness and stupidity, it's like dealing with a little child. You know, it becomes kind of cute, and you pat him on the head and you say, there, there. And he doesn't do any harm. But you have to be aware of the pettiness and smallness of the illusionary ego that goes through the life. But it doesn't. There's a nice saying, a Buddhist saying, where, what does the sage say? He looks back on his life and he says, engrossed with personal affairs, I forgot who I am.
Engrossed with personal affairs, I forgot who I am?
Yeah, because you're not really that. You're just pretending to be that little person who lives a very short and temporary life. But it's nice to be aware of it, rather than, otherwise you identify with it, and that is horrible.
Now, one of the characters in your mystery series is a jazz musician. He plays trumpet. And I understand that that's one of your ambitions, that one of your regrets, actually, that you don't play.
Yeah.
Why don't we end the interview with one of your favorite jazz trumpeters? Would you like to choose somebody?
Oh, Miles Davis.
Miles Davis? Okay. Is that how you would have liked to play if you could play?
Well, I don't want to imitate him, but I'm very pleased that at least somebody can play, because if I listen to him, all my questions really fall away. Music is such a direct way, and on his level, it's just beautiful.
Any particular Miles period you'd like to select?
Well, he had his own composition, So What?
Of course. The perfect choice for you. We'll play So What.
Yeah.
Jan-Willem van de Wettering, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jan-Willem van de Wettering's latest novel is called The Hollow-Eyed Angel. Coming up, reinterpreting the music of Henry Mancini. This is Fresh Air. The music of Henry Mancini might strike you as kind of middle of the road, so why is a group of adventurous jazz musicians reinterpreting it? My guest Matt Brudbeck is the leader of the band Orange Symphonette. Their debut album is devoted to the music of Mancini and features such well-known tunes as the Pink Panther theme, Moon River, Charade, and the Baby Elephant Walk. Brudbeck has described their interpretations as uneasy listening. Brubeck is a cellist who's a member of the Berklee Symphony. He's arranged music for the Kronos Quartet and has composed for the Clubfoot Orchestra. He's also the son of Dave Brubeck, the celebrated jazz pianist and composer. Here's the Orange Symphonette's version of the Inspector Clouseau theme. Why Henry Mancini?
Well, first off, I think the most important thing to realize is I'd like to give credit where credit is due, is that as much as I would like to think this was entirely my idea, it is not. It was actually my wife's idea to do Mancini. And she actually said, you know, you really got to listen to this music. Someone needs to be doing this. And you know, way before Mancini actually died. And she really felt that was really deserving of reinterpretation and suggested that, you know, she said, yeah, you know a lot of great musicians. Why don't you put together a project to do this? And around the same time, what happened is that we actually had a gig lined up at an experimental musical space called Radio Valencia. And I assembled this group of players who I had met playing with Tom Waits, working on The Night on Earth and the Black Rider projects. And we went in there hardly knowing what we were doing, but the musical result was so great that we decided to stick with the project.
What do you like about Henry Mancini's music, and what works for you in terms of improvising from it?
You know, I always think that if the melody is good, then, you know, the rest of it just kind of follows naturally. So first of all, you have these really strong melodies and good structures to work with. Secondly, Mancini was really fond of using very kind of oddball orchestration, which I'm really into, like using zithers and, like, you know, the calliope on the baby elephant. On the Baby Elephant Walk, and tape echo delays, Chinese gongs, and he was the first guy to also kind of use sort of, you know, the cheesy rock or jazz combo as kind of a musical device in, you know, in a Hollywood movie, and I just love the sound.
Well, let me play something else from the new Henry Mancini record, and I thought we'd play Charade, the theme that he wrote for the movie Charade, which starred Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn. This is a lovely waltz, which you don't do as a waltz, nor do you do it as a lovely song. you arranged this track. Tell me about your arrangement.
Well, it was kind of my somewhat irreverent idea to. I just really thought that Charade worked better in four, even though kind of.
In four quarter time,
rather, and even though it kind of required squeezing the music into 10-bar phrases when most music is in 8-bar phrases, it just worked really great. The thing that came to me is this sort of James Brown kind of guitar lick, and the melody just works so great over it. And then actually, in honor of the original, we do slip into a waltz in the bridge, but we kind of really play it like, I don't know, a drunken cabaret band more than anything else.
Well, this is Orange Symphonette playing Henry Mancini's theme from Charade. And my guest is Matt Brubeck, the leader of the band and the cellist. Orange Symphonette. My guest, Matt Brubeck, is the leader of the band and the cellist. I'm wondering if you have played a lot of more straight-ahead jazz, and if you still do much of that.
Yeah. I have other music projects that I'm involved with which are more straight-ahead.
I guess here's what I'm wondering. Were there a lot of standards that you used to play that you just got really tired of, that got really worn out for you, and you wanted to find new, fresher material?
That is true. I don't think that I got as jaded and burnt out as some saxophonist who's played, you know, Girl from Ipanema on his 100th casual that year. And in fact, there's standards that I would like to explore more and delve into. So I really wasn't coming from that position so much as actually a lot of it was just that playing jazz that had this air of complete seriousness about it was so much work that I really felt, you know, why not have this project where the point of departure is just this music that is relatively, you know, easy to learn and is familiar material for a lot of people from the audience, but let's then take it to this place that's really far out. In other words, I've been in love with a lot of original music things in which the starting point was pretty obscure and then would like get even more obscure. And I thought, well, let's like have this stuff where the starting point is like, you know, the Pink Panther. Got, you know, almost every person in the world knows that tune. And then let's just take that, you know, fairly out.
Your father is the pianist and composer Dave Brubeck. And I'm wondering what your earliest musical memories are.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty easy, actually. Earliest musical memories are quartet rehearsals with Eugene Wright, Joe Morello, and Paul Desmond. And Eugene used to take the train up so he wouldn't bring his bass with him. So my dad had this kind of K rehearsal bass, which used to be under the piano. And I used to sit on top of it and just kind of pluck the notes during rehearsals. And I used to love being underneath the roar of the piano during rehearsals. So that's, you know, that is a very early musical memory. And also my dad practicing, you know, at night on a little spinet in the bedroom. And my room was right across the hall from my parents' bedroom and kind of hearing that, you know, those muffled tones. And when I go home, you know, I'll still hear him practicing and it'll put me right back to that kind of childhood space. And it's like a very familiar, you know, scent at grandma's house or something.
And when you were a child, did your father's playing seem impressive or just a fact?
Oh, even as a child, I was always impressed with it musically. I think where it was just a fact was that I don't think I really recognized how much work he had done prior to my being born, and you know, all the time on the road and like the whole quartet, you know, driving across the country in like an old Bentley, you know, kind of stuff. What I was naive about is you know, how much work went into the level of success. And you know, you have to keep in mind that unlike my oldest brother Darius, who is 14 years older than me, I was born really at the peak of my father's success. So it's like I just came into the world with, you know, Time magazine covers and all these awards and, you know, successful international touring and being this, you know, jazz U.S. goodwill ambassador. And I really wasn't that aware until I got older of, you know, just the endless nights playing, you know, in these dives and, you know, mafioso, you know, pointing guns at him and saying, you better play this or that. And, you know, just all this kind of, you know, musician's dues that he went through in the late 40s and 50s. Yeah.
So does it ever seem like you and your brother Darius were raised by different fathers? You were raised by a famous father and he was raised by a struggling artist?
Yeah, I think it is really, I think that it's interesting because in many ways Darius and I are very similar, but we have this very, I think we had very different growing up experiences. I mean, Darius was babysit by Lenny Bruce for a little while.
Can you
imagine a worse babysitter?
And, that's, you know, risky, isn't it?
That's risky, yeah. Well, yeah, because my parents were real good friends with Mort Saul, and Mort Saul, I guess, said, well, I've got this guy, Lenny, this is unemployed friend. But, you know, and then, you know, I grew up in this, like, beautiful house in the countryside in Connecticut, and, you know, my Darius grew up in, you know, this little ramshackled apartment on 18th and Castro in San Francisco. You know, very different experience.
My guest is Matt Brubeck, leader of the Orange Symphonette. Their debut album is devoted to the music of Henry Mancini. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with cellist Matt Brubeck, leader of the Orange Symphonette. Their debut CD features reinterpretations of music by Henry Mancini. Matt is the son of Dave Brubeck. How did you choose cello to be your instrument?
I think I just like the sound of it. It was interesting. I started as a pianist, and the typical school system things. Oh, so you're a pianist, so it means you can read treble clef and bass clef. Well, we need some bass clef instruments for the school orchestra, and so I started out on this beat up, with initials carved in it, kind of cello, and but I heard the Tokyo String Quartet play in a local concert fairly early on, and I really loved the sound of the cello then. I think they were playing Bartok. And also next-door neighbor who turned out later to be my cello teacher at Yale was Aldo Paraso, a wonderful Brazilian cellist and really fabulous teacher. And I think, I heard some recitals, and my older brothers were friends of Aldo's kids. And so if I was tagging along with them, literally we'd walk through the woods between house and house, and I would hear Aldo practicing a lot. So I think that combination of factors and maybe sitting on that bass and plucking it. Subsequently, actually, I've learned to play bass with the Orange Symphonette. I really would hesitate to say that I'm a bass player. I'm foremost a cellist. And actually, my second instrument, I would say, really would be piano, and thirdly, a bass player.
Has it been hard to find places to play cello?
Yeah, because it's mostly because it's a quiet instrument. That's really the struggle, because you have this kind of dilemma in which the more you amplify the cello, the less like a cello it sounds, sort of no matter what you do. And I've spent years fiddling around with electronics. I have a very good solid body electric cello, which people come up to me and say, God, that's the best sounding, electric bowed string instrument I've ever heard. And, I'm very satisfied with it in terms of like this band plays, can play fairly loud. And, when I use that, but, nothing replaces an acoustic. And so if I was in an ideal world, I would always play, the acoustic cello if I could, just because I have this more immediate. I like the way the thing vibrates against your chest. That's such a part of the cello experience. Yeah.
Did you ever study with your father?
That's a kind of interesting anecdote. This is something that actually all my older brothers and I, we had this experience where my dad would sneak out the back door, ring the front doorbell, and we had these appointed lesson times, and he'd be wearing like these Groucho Marx glasses with a little mustache and a funny hat and a beat up coat. And he was like, Dr. Quackenbush or something like that. And he teaches piano lessons as another person.
Wow.
And
did that because?
I think he did that. I don't know. I think, maybe he'd been reading Benjamin Spock or something. I'm not sure. I think he realized that we all had natural curiosity to learn from him, but I think that he also thought that it would be a lot easier for us to just make it like a game, first of all, because it was game and pretend and kind of fun. And I think he was beginning to sense the sort of, burden of his success on us, and, or he could foresee that happening. And I think he wanted to teach us, but he also wanted to just keep it kind of, fun. And it seems to sort of vacate some of the psychological burden of the whole thing.
Well, let's close our interview with another track from the Orange Symphonette's Henry Mancini record. Why don't we hear Moon River? This is an interesting arrangement, which has two discrete parts. Why don't you talk about this a little bit?
I would say that a lot of people have commented they really hear the Tom Waits influence in Moon River.
And a lot of the musicians on the band have played with Tom Waits.
Right. And it's because it has this ethereal floating kind of everyone's kind of reaching somewhere kind of feel to it. And then that's, you know, that's the first part. And the second – and it's also such a beautiful melody. It really deserves – it lays so great on the cello. It's really great. And then the second part of Moon River is a cha-cha, and a lot of people say, boy, that was like this really sick idea you guys had. And then I have to correct them and say, well, actually, if you watch Breakfast at Tiffany's, Moon River as a cha-cha is the background music for the really chaotic, out-of-control party scene at Holly Go Lightly's apartment. So we're just actually, you know, just doing what Henry did with it, just taking it a little more chaotically.
Matt Brubeck, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
And this is more music from Orange Symphonette plays Henry Mancini, a band that's led by Matt Brubeck, who's the cellist with the group. We'll be right back.